CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome Oliver Morton of The Economist magazine to celebrate with me the life of James Lovelock, 1919 to 2022. He's just left us. A very famous man, if you understand the Gaia hypothesis of 60 years ago. It belongs to James Lovelock eventually. And also the eve of discovering what could be validation or not of his thinking, that you look to the atmospheres of planets, exoplanets would be the example, in order to define disequilibrium. And that will be part of the mystery needed to solve. Is there life outside of planet Earth? Oliver, it's a joy to welcome you. This piece is wonderful. You knew James Lovelock.
Yes, I read
about him, but was he really Q, Oliver? Was he really James Bond's Q?
I don't know as to that. It is certainly true that when he was when he left medical research to become an independent scientist in the 1960s, he did a significant amount of work for the security services. And I'm sure that when my friend Jonathan Watts's biography of him comes out, it will look into this. So he certainly did some peculiar things, because his and Q is in some ways, I mean. In the books, I don't think there really is a Q. There's just Q Branch. I think the character of Q really comes from the movies. But there is something, there's a term that the English use about a certain sort of scientist, referring to him as a boffin. And it more or less always is a him in this case. And boffin has a slightly upper class aspect that doesn't really apply to Jim. But the idea of someone who fiddled with gadgets with great delight, that applies to Jim completely. And one of his, I think one of the things that made him intellectually so interesting and his thought so provocative and fertile was that he sort of saw planets as gadgets too, things that had sort of like little control systems and all sorts of intricacies that, you know, if you really thought about it, you could understand how they worked. And that was essential to most of his later work, I think.
Chemistry was the reason he went to the JPL in the 1960s. He was asked to develop sensitivities or instruments. This is for the Viking program of 1976 that could detect life on Mars or lead to speculation about life on Mars. And therein lies the tale of the Gaia hypothesis. I learned from Oliver that we're looking for disequilibrium in atmospheres, a product of entropy. Can you explain, Oliver, please?
Yes, and it's slightly more complicated than that. I mean, Jim was asked to go to NASA because he had a great expertise in a particular application of a technique called gas chromatography that actually he'd learned about from its creator while they'd both been standing on the roofs of buildings in London during the war trying to see where fires broke out. So Jim invented this thing called the electron capture detector, which was incredibly sensitive. Among other things, it was the device that first showed the buildup of toxic pesticides in the environment that was chronicled by Rachel Carson. And NASA wanted the most sensitive possible probes for its space missions, especially, as you say, its Mars mission. And so they asked Jim, who by that time was an independent scientist, he'd left his day job, to go and consult with them. But although he was very happy to work on the work on their machines, and you know, the gas, the sensors he designed are now still on Mars on the Viking landers, he wasn't convinced that this was the way to look for life, because he thought about the Earth, and he thought that in Earth, the signs of life in the atmosphere are not subtle. The signs of life in the atmosphere are absolutely blatant, in that the atmosphere is effectively, I can't remember who used this phrase first, a slow flame. It contains methane and it contains oxygen. And these are two things which combust, and left to itself, the atmosphere could not possibly look like this. And so to a chemist like Lovelock, this state of, you know, being about to react is called a state of chemical disequilibrium. And Lovelock realized that life was fundamental to this disequilibrium. It was because of plants and methane-producing bacteria that the atmosphere was so spectacularly out of whack. And he came to the conclusion that that was, in fact, diagnostic of a planet that had life, that life would use the atmosphere to dump things which would, for various reasons, react with each other. And it would then, other forms of life would then take that disequilibrium and make use of it. And that made him think that, look at the gross facts of the atmosphere of Mars or Venus, and you find it's in complete, almost complete chemical equilibrium. There are no reactions waiting to happen there. And so he, somewhere between deduced and intuited, that there was no, certainly no large-scale life on either of those planets. And it became part of his belief that life on a planet had to be either large-scale, it had to be a dominant factor of the planet as it is on Earth, or it wasn't really there. And so he came to believe, well before the Viking missions, that they would find no life on Mars. And so far, that has been the way that it has played.
So as you put it in your essay for The Economist, if the atmosphere is not a background to life, it's a product of life, and it's maintained in its chemical disequilibrium by constantly being replenished by organisms from the planet. Is that all correct?
Yeah, that's absolute. You put your finger on the essence of it, John. That's exactly right.
Now, this observation, it turns out, who remembers the 1960s accurately, Oliver? It's all a fog to me. But in any event, this was appropriated culturally as exciting, to calling planet Earth living. That was overmuch, and James Lovelock never went that far. It wasn't a living planet. It was evidence of life on Earth. Do I say that correctly?
This was, yes. I mean, in the 1960s, he saw the atmosphere as evidence that Earth was, in some sense, that Earth was a habitable planet with life on it. In the 1970s, he did go a little bit further, because he started thinking about how it was that, though the atmosphere was in radical disequilibrium, it was also stable. And he began to hypothesize that maybe life was not just responsible for the environment, but that it was also keeping the environment in some way to its liking. And that was a strong version of what became known as Gaia. That was sort of like the Gaia hypothesis. And it wasn't, in the end, the view of life on Earth that Jim ended up with, but it was a very powerful idea, the idea that the Earth was in some ways like a living organism. As I say, not the way that Jim would have approached the question in later life, when he was more interested not in whether the Earth was alive, and certainly not in whether it was an organism, but how one could speak of the Earth as alive. But yes, in the 1970s, the fact that a scientist was saying that that there was this thing called Gaia, ancient Greek word for the Earth Mother Goddess, and that it was in some way alive, was very widely taken up in countercultural circles, and led to embarrassed, straight-laced scientists treating Jim with an unreasonable level of disdain.
Yes, much like some other geniuses have gone through a transformation in their own lifetimes. I'm looking, however, at the fact that you use the methane and oxygen example. You also evidence that the nitrogen in our atmosphere needs to be replenished. How does that happen?
Ah, well, the nitrogen cycle, which is peculiarly dear to my heart, is another part of the influence of life. If you look at the atmospheres of Mars and Venus, there's very little nitrogen. If you ask where the nitrogen in the Earth's atmosphere comes from, you find that it comes from microbes which break down nitrates and ammonia and make molecular nitrogen. Now, the interesting thing is that there are other microbes that take molecular nitrogen and turn it into nitrates and ammonia. And there's a whole cycle of this around the world. But if that cycle were to stop, the nitrogen would all end up over time dissolved as nitrate in the sea. And so the fact that the bulk of the Earth's atmosphere, even though most living things just breathe it in and breathe it out and don't worry about it, that nitrogen is more evidence of the fact that the Earth is alive. The Earth's atmosphere is entirely, peculiarly, and rather wonderfully a construct.
I'm speaking with Oliver Morton of The Economist magazine about James Lovelock, who's just left us, and his thinking about looking to the atmospheres of a planet. Planet Earth, planet Mars, planet Venus were available in the 20th century, and looking to the atmospheres of the exoplanets now being cataloged for evidence of something alive maintaining the conditions that we can find as disequilibrium, chemical disequilibrium, in the atmosphere. However, Oliver also takes us through the course of our own planet from about 4.5 billion years ago until about the Cambrian explosion for how we got to life here when we come back. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.